I'm going to be joined. I'm Phil Brining, data protection people. I'm going to be joined by two of my excellent consulting colleagues, Dave Holmes and Ollie Rea. They can say hello in a second. Now, we're going to be talking about international data transfers. So another quick one in terms of content disclaimer. We do talk sometimes a whole load of rubbish in these sessions. And, you know, we like to explore themes and argue with each other. So, you know, not everything that we talk about is advice, and not everything about it is kind of exploring. The objective is to kind of provoke thought and, you know, challenge people's thinking or, you know, so if you have any specifics you want to be clear about, then, you know, please, you know, get in touch. So you said this in the session. You know, what was the bottom line here? You know, is that something we can act on, or was it just part of the general discussion? So please don't take these discussions as absolute gospel. Sometimes, you know, we early on adopting the guidance, we're interpreting it, and sometimes our opinions will change over time as things develop. So Dave, Ollie, say hello.
Hi, welcome everybody. And just to fill in on what Phil was just adding there, occasionally we also take kind of opposite tracks to just to enable debate, really, kind of taking kind of the devil's advocate kind of stance. So some of the comments may not necessarily represent accurate thinking on the topic. Some of it's there, obviously, to incorporate discussion as well, and to get points to come alive. In essence, what Phil and Ollie do quite regularly on non-recorded versions, where we kind of try to think outside the box a little bit as well. So hopefully you'll find it entertaining. But thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Yes, hello all, and I don't have a disclaimer like that. So,
we don't normally, and again, those of you regulars here, we don't normally kind of have a PowerPoint presentation we don't like that. We like to have just a bit of a chat. But on this topic, we thought we'd maybe illustrate a few points with a couple of slides. And again, you can have these for what they're worth. So what we're going to try and talk about is international transfers. You know, what should you do right now? People keep asking us, what should you do right now? In fact, you had one question this morning, didn't you, Dave, from a client saying, you know, right, I've got this now from a client, you know, do I have to fill it in? Do you want to expand on that?
Yeah, absolutely. The client's in essence a processor. They've got an applicant tracking system, so they've got a range of different clients in the UK and into Europe, and they received a revised set of standard contractual clauses that the client wanted, their client wanted them to sign and agree to. I had a quick look at the standard contractual clauses, and still relate to the old 95 directive, EU directive, which gave the game away slightly that there weren't the new proposed standard contractual clauses, because the consultation period on that doesn't end until tomorrow, so hopefully they weren't using the consultation process. But yeah, these things happening, it's a kind of maybe an example that supply chain led development is also appearing with organisations pushing now to kind of go, and this is developing. How do you demonstrate your own compliance? So they had received an update in order to still facilitate transfers to and from the UK in the event of Brexit.
So there are things that people should be doing right now, which we're going to cover off. But that's one of the topics to talk about today. And then there's a lot out still to be determined. And you know, we'll explore how those things might play out in the longer term being kind of the next 12 months, isn't it, really? And some might come through quicker.
Might be 12 hours if you're talking Brexit, Phil.
It might be, yeah.
You've made it have gone to Belgium to kind of finalise things or to kind of iron out some wrinkles. So it's just a very fast-paced and developing environment at the moment.
Yeah, and then finally, you know, effectively, what does that mean we might have to do? So some of this is going to be conjecture, some of it will be ideas, but, you know, a lot of it is based on experience. So that's really what we're going to try and talk about. Should we cover off news items now, or should we do that at the end? I mean, I've noticed some stuff, you know, the Canela being active, I was talking to Ollie about that, the French citizens are being active, complaining about a new privacy laws, and there was the white paper on social housing, which we've had a look at, and the probable information standard, information public provision standard that will involve. So there's quite a bit of stuff to talk about in terms of current affairs, but should we do that at the end? Should we get into this topic now while we're in the mood for it? Yeah, why not?
Yeah.
So, right. So again, we'll try and talk. Let's talk this through, right? The three of us. So what we know is that from the 1st of January, the UK GDPR will replace EU GDPR, where you're processing personal data in the UK. It'll affect both UK and EU based organisations, won't it? So you're a French company providing services or monitoring behaviour, whatever, in the UK, they will have to comply with the UK GDPR, won't they?
Yes. Yeah, everything that that we know about the GDPR as it currently stands is still going to be replicated, but split. So you've got the UK version of the GDPR and the EU version of the GDPR. So it's still going to have extraterritorial reach. You'll still have two different regimes on depending if you're, say, sat in France offering services in the UK or sat in the UK offering services to France. And you're going to have two very similar but two different kind of standards to demonstrate that you comply with.
Yeah, and is that a document of, I mean, we've got a copy of it. Where is that document? I can't remember where we got it from. We've had it for a year, haven't we?
The UK GDPR.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's the Keeling schedule, isn't it? So it's all been kind of, I've got a copy of it somewhere, yeah. That kind of, all it does is the UK version is really just being tweaked to make sense in the UK. So it won't refer to things like member state law and the EU courts. It'll refer to UK provisions, but in essence, everything else stays the same. What it does highlight, though, is that if any of your documentation refers to the GDPR, you may need to differentiate between whether it's the UK or the EU, depending on your own processing activities.
Yes, really. As a processor and a controller, you might be caught by both the GDPR, UK GDPR, and the EU GDPR. So we're going to see these two terms emerging out of the UK GDPR, EU GDPR. It's going to be really confusing. The GDPR is now going to have two-headed beast, isn't it?
Well, it is. I'd like to think it's going to be less confusing because the in essence, the UK version is just a reprint of the EU version, just slightly tweaked. But you can imagine over time as divergences set in, if there's no kind of an adequacy agreement, that the laws may start to diverge. And where they start to diverge, it will then become a bit of a beast to manage. I think in the early days, could potentially appear, in my naivety at least, it's going to be relatively simple. But as case law develops and whether we're bound by EU case law or EU decisions, or whether we just give it persuasive guidance, and what does that mean for tracking alongside its equivalent, or do the tracks then start to separate in that sense?
Yeah, and Ollie, the things we know is if you're selling goods, services, or monitoring people's behaviour in the EU, then you know if you're a UK controller, you have to appoint a representative, or if you're providing processor services into EU countries and suppliers, you need to provide also appoint a representative. Don't we know that bit, don't we? And if you have a breach, you're going to have to report it potentially to two supervisory authorities, one in the EU and one in the UK. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. You're referring to Article 27, aren't you, there? And the fact that, I mean, there are some exemptions to this requirement to put in place representatives, but it's certainly going to be interesting, and particularly that point that you've hit on there in terms of breach reporting and how that's going to operate. It's possibly slightly off topic at this juncture, but I have been reading some commentary about outsourced representatives recently. So particularly companies in Ireland offering UK companies representative across the EU and how that might affect things. So it's certainly quite an interesting area.
What have you read on that then?
Well, just that it's an industry or an aspect of the industry anyway that is likely to boom with particularly sort of medium-sized organisations who all of a sudden are put in quite a tricky position where they might actually be required to appoint a representative pursuant to Article 27, but obviously they won't have had, you know, offices in the EU the way that sort of larger companies will, and they won't be able to rely on exemptions the way that smaller companies do. So it's quite interesting to see how that side of the industry might blow up, but also by the same token, there's going to be a risk for the companies providing that service, because you don't necessarily want to take on board clients who are going to be reckless and hold your hand up as saying that you're their representative. So really, really quite an interesting double-edged sword there, I suppose.
Yeah, and there's definitely complications, which we won't go into today, for if you or have already appointed a lead supervisory authority where you're established both in the UK and the EU. So these are the things we know. We also know that going forward after the 1st of January, transferring data from the UK to the EU is okay, because the UK government have said that, haven't they?
Yes, they have. Yeah, they've come out and agreed that that's okay.
Yeah, and then what we also know is that transferring personal data to a third country needs to be subject to more due diligence. That was what we were talking about last time, wasn't it, 10 days ago, where we've got these European essential guarantees and these supplementary measures and the new standard contractual clause. This is all kind of a result of Schrems, isn't it, Dave?
It is. Schrems was quite interesting, wasn't it, as a case? A lot of the principles in Schrems, although it kind of invalidated Privacy Shield, it doesn't invalidate the use of standard contractual clauses, but it means on their own that they may not be suitable as a transfer mechanism because they may not provide an essential level may not necessarily provide an essentially equivalent level of protection as what you get in the EU. So although as a mechanism that they may be appropriate, there's certainly more work you need to do around the areas of using standard contractual clauses. And then that the ramifications for that is when whichever country you're using standard contractual clauses as a transfer mechanism to, it certainly the essence of Schrems isn't just related to information going to and from the US.
Yeah. So the bit that we don't know yet is whether the UK will be granted an adequacy decision, meaning that transfers of data from the EU to the UK are also okay. Because if we're not granted an adequacy decision, will be a third country, and therefore transfers from the EU to the UK will be exactly the same as transfers currently from the UK to North Korea, you know, subject to stringent controls. I tell you what was interesting, I'd look at the CNIL's website earlier in the day, and they've got this map of adequacy, and look, they've highlighted the UK as adequate. Do you think there's something that they know that we don't?
having read through the CNIL's website this morning, I'm not entirely sure. but I did find quite this possibly slightly off topic and more for the news segment, but I think it probably fits in here in terms of the Schrems case and how this might inform us going forward. I saw that the CNIL in particular had an issue with a French service called the Health Data Hub. And I don't know if you've read about this, which is essentially a service for all French patients. They upload their information to it, but it's hosted by Microsoft fundamentally, and it's full of health data. So obviously, in terms of the Schrems judgment, there are implications to that. And basically, the CNIL went to the French Supreme Court and said, we want you to stop these transfers because it's fundamentally a government initiative. So we want you to stop these transfers because we feel that all this health data is not secured. And so they have now required the French government and Microsoft to work towards these EEGs,
right,
these extra guarantees. But they have deemed that in the meantime, due to the public health crisis currently, they've deemed that actually the risk of health data being sent to America is proportionate considering the need for access to critical health services currently, but that in future they're going to move those services to European and French potentially servers. Off the back of the Schrems judgment. So I thought that was actually really quite interesting to see this sort of playing out on a practical level.
Yeah, there's a couple of bits in there. There's certainly a couple of bits in there, Ollie, that I'd like to kind of explore further as well. I know it's probably going slightly off topic and I apologise about that, but there's just because of the extraterritorial reach of FISA, so if it's caught by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of the US, which is targeted at non-EU citizens, and therefore parent US companies with EU subsidy companies may well be caught by the FISA Act, whether they've got any supplementary measures that would protect it or provide that information with essentially equivalent level of protection, that may otherwise be still caught by FISA and the issues identified in Schrems.
Yeah, so as far as I can tell, basically they've asked them to look at those supplementary measures, but currently they're not implemented or they don't exist. But as I say, they've done this sort of balancing act whereby they've found that by virtue of the public health crisis that it's actually justified to take that risk with the data. However, bearing in mind that in future they'll be looking to move away from Microsoft to minimise that risk and relocalise the servers in the EU.
Oh, that's interesting. So that's kind of government initiative. I mean, and whether we could argue the same kind of, oh, this is proportionate for my own kind of business activities, I wouldn't have thought that we would have the same imperative, would you?
No, I wouldn't have thought so, no. I think, to be fair, from what I can understand, the Supreme Court has made a really exceptional judgment on this, the French Supreme Court, that is, on the basis purely of the COVID health crisis. I think that's probably the only reason they've gotten away with it.
Right. Okay. Excellent.
So, sorry for the veering off topic.
No, interesting stuff. Yeah. So, Well, we're going to kind of just visually kind of work through. Well, what we know is if you're a controller in the UK, currently you're bound by the UK, the EU GDPR, transfers to and from the EEA are green to go, no problem, because we're all in the same club. Transfers to the US are bound by Chapter 5 of the EU GDPR, and therefore they require some adequacy mechanism. Transfers back are governed by US law, so they don't have the same level of control over them. So that's current situation. Processors in Europe, not a problem. You know, you're transferring data into the processors in the EEA. And again, that's all just bound by Article 28 contracts and processors rather than having to consider Article 46. If you're providing goods and services into the EEA, again, same applies. You can do that and you're governed and regulated by the EU GDPR. So, my take on how it's going to be after the 1st of January, we're governed by the UK GDPR and transfers to the US are exactly the same because the UK GDPR is the same in essence as the EU GDPR. So Chapter 5 of the UK GDPR will be identical, won't it? So transfers out are governed by those adequacy mechanisms and safeguards. Transfers back, no change. Transfers to the EU are fine as well because the UK government have currently said that that's their take on it, that Europe's a safe place to transfer data to. But transfers back might not be, because if we're not granted an adequacy decision, any transfer to the UK is governed. We would be a third country and that would be governed under the EU GDPR by Chapter 5 of the GDPR. Well, again, that's how I think it is. So if you've got a processor that you're using, and this could be Ireland, but my red arrow is across it. So Microsoft in Ireland, we're going to pick on this one in a second. You might well be able to easily transfer data to them, but they would have to go to great lengths to transfer it back. Great lengths being to enter into some safeguard or adequacy mechanism if the UK isn't granted an adequacy decision. If you're providing goods and services into the EU or monitoring behaviour and the other things that kind of the extraterritorial reach demands, then you will also be governed by the EU GDPR. And the little bell there is a kind of a hotel service desk. You'll have to have a representative over there if you're, as Ollie said, caught by Article 27. So there's a scenario where you're caught by two sets of law, and the transfers to and from the EU, to is easy, from is not easy, and to the US is still the same as it is now. Is that about how you see it, kind of as a visual representation, you guys?
Yeah, I think it represents it pretty well, and it's in line with my thinking of how it all currently sits.
Yeah, so we want to look at some specifics. So scenario one, I got asked a support desk inbound support ticket was, we use Cognito forms. Would you have a look at it for us and tell us what you think we need to do? So this scenario, I believe, applies to MailChimp, SurveyMonkey, Hootsuite and a host of other organizations who say that they are processing data, storing data in the US. So the transfer of data to Cognito Forms is now subject, looks like, well, it is now subject to an Article 45, 46 transfer mechanism. So standard contractual clauses, is the point. But now we've got to take this extra step, haven't we? We've got to do the European Essential Guarantees. We've got to do a due diligence exercise on the US as a place, or potentially the state within the US where the place we're processing the data. And we then probably have to implement additional supplementary measures, or SMs at point four, for each recipient in that supply chain. So what is it, this again, how you read it, Dave, Ollie? And because it's a processor, Article 28 standard contractual clauses apply as well as Article 46 standard contractual clauses.
Yeah, for sure. Sorry if I jumped in there before you, Ollie. I'm pleased to come in. Yeah, for sure, that's how I see it. It leads you to question, or to pose a question at least. We've got to undertake and document EEGs. Who's the responsibility for doing that? Is that on the controller that's doing the transfer and working with the importing company? Or is it, are they expecting supervisory authorities to undertake that work to determine that the EEGs are in place and therefore it's just supplementary measures that you've got to review yourself?
What's your thoughts on that, Ollie? I've got some thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think it's quite interesting. I mean, we've referred to a number of times how, in theory, this could be a really burdensome process, especially for smaller scale organisations. So I think it'd be interesting to see if the supervisor authority is willing to take the lead on this. However, I don't think they will. No, I'd be surprised. But I think it's going to certainly be difficult for smaller scale organisations on both sides of this arrangement, actually. Because if you're a smaller processor in the US, I think you're going to be, it's going to significantly restrict your ability to do business in the UK. I think it's going to be quite interesting.
I don't think they will take the lead because when we spoke to the ICO about certain things, they've kind of said, well, we don't want to do things that people can say, well, you said it was okay. So I think that they won't do the European essential guarantees because it puts them firmly in the frame for taking the blame if the EEGs aren't right or if they move. I don't think they've got the resources to review 248 or however many countries are in the world and document them. So I don't think they will. And the guidance we talked about last week says that you've got to do it as a controller, doesn't it?
Well, it would make sense as a controller because the controller is the one who's deciding where the information is going to go. He's got the ability to appoint suppliers and bits and pieces to help them deliver their services. It would make sense it sits squarely with the controller. But I absolutely get Ollie's point in the fact that and we've seen it previously with when we've done due diligence on some processes where the smaller organisations may not even be aware that they're doing international transfers. Or have the ability to engage with trying to understand local laws and the nuances and ambiguities within local laws to make the decision as whether essential guarantees are actually achieved or not. Yeah. So I think Ollie's got a very, very valid point on that.
Yeah. So I flagged up a few again. Practically, how do you do this? Well, there are some good resources on international data protection laws, but some of them are out of date and they're not always necessarily kept up to date or they're only looking at data protection law rather than the other law that might impact data protection law, which is what the essential guarantees are concerned about. So, for instance, Linklaters have got quite a good resource here on their website. So you can go on and have a look at various countries. Here they are listed down here and find out more about, you know, how their data protection laws work and the coverage and the requirements. I've used this for donkey's years, the DLA Piper one. It's pretty good. You know, it's not fully comprehensive, but it's a good start. But it gives you, there are some resources out there where you can have a look at the territories that you're transferring data to. And because this is territorially based rather than transferee based, i.e., you know, once you've assessed India, that assessment isn't going to vary for other suppliers in India unless it's a federation and you've got different laws in each state, which in some countries might be the case. But again, I'm right on that, Dave. So, you know, once you've assessed India, until something changes in India or until something changes at this end in terms of the interpretation of the law, that assessment of the European essential guarantees is fine for all transfers to India.
I would agree. obviously, you still need to keep a watching outlook on India to see whether any other laws change that might mean that your assessment needs to be rerun or undertaken because of how laws can be introduced that could unpick all of that. But for sure, if you've assessed India, then I would have said from the essential guarantees point. And it's come out in favour that you've got essentially equivalent level of protection, and that's fine. It doesn't remove the ability then to look at your standard, your supplementary measures at point four, on the screen that you're displaying at the moment. But once you've assessed India as being fine, then, like you say, unless anything changes, I would take that as yes, that's fine.
Yeah. So my prediction is that somebody or some bodies are going to perform those European essential guarantees. And once they've been done once, let's say for the US or let's say for a state, Florida within the US, then that is done until something changes is my premise.
Well, I could see people giving advice, a bit like the DLA Piper and the other websites that you brought up, giving advice and guidance on what to look. But I'd also like to think that similar websites would carry a disclaimer saying the responsibility for checking it out rests with the controller. Because last thing you want to do is say, well, the DLA Piper said it was fine, and you just lifted something off their website instead of paying for official advice.
Well, that's the key, isn't it? Somebody wants to, you know, there's an opportunity to commercialise this information. But let's say that in the industry we have most clients in the social housing industry, yeah, and somebody does, pays for an assessment of the United States of America, then why would you not share that European Essential Guarantees due diligence risk assessment with your peers and get a contribution to the cost? So what I'm saying is I can't see that really it's commercializable in the long run. Once the information's out, then the monitoring of the various territories is the key, isn't it? But once, you know, everyone knows that it's okay in the US and it's okay for Hootsuite, it's okay for SurveyMonkey, it's okay for MailChimp, and it's okay for Cognito Forms, unless there's other links in the data transfer chain, which takes it out of the US.
For sure. Or whether you appoint somebody in the US to say that their essential guarantees is fine, and then they further sub-process that then bounces the information elsewhere, because as a controller, you've got to ensure that the equivalence level of security follows the chain. So it's not just the primary processor. If the primary processor is further sub-processing themselves, there's still an obligation to ensure that the security and the level of protection follow.
Yeah. So documenting your data flows, again, that's one thing that should be happening now. That is definitely one of those things that we should be doing right now, because we need to, this is going to affect those flows. I think if we can move on to scenario two, which is one we've been asked about a number of times, including last week's session. Microsoft Office 365, yeah? So data storage is in Ireland. So, transferring data to Ireland on the face of it under the UK GDPR is fine because Ireland is a member state of the EU. The problem is the onward transfer or the ability of the American government to access that data through FISA and potentially other US law. That's the issue, isn't it? And then, of course, you've got the complication of Ireland saying, well, actually, we can't transfer data back to you until we've got some kind of mechanism because you're a third country, if that's how it works out. But this is the bit here, isn't it? That's the problem, this transfer to the US.
For sure. And if you kind of just look back a little bit, prior to FISA, you had a range of different US laws. So you had the Stored Communication Act, which wasn't considered as extraterritorial by the US courts when there was a court case between the US government and Microsoft for that very reason, where they kind of said, we're based in Ireland, you can't touch us. So then that was kind of replaced by the Cloud Act in order to correct that ability, supported by FISA since, making it extraterritorial. So it's all that kind of complications there with the US trying to obtain information on non-US citizens is probably the better way providing, so it's certainly not just targeted at the EU.
But there
is added complications in addition to the information coming back from Ireland to the UK following Brexit. If there's no adequacy rating or agreement in place getting it back in that sense, and we can look at some of those moving forward, but yes, definitely the information being bounced further onto the US from Ireland.
So that transfer back from Ireland to the UK, I'm seeing as a relatively easily solvable piece of the picture. As a processor, Microsoft would have to ensure that there was a standard contractual clause as processor controller in the new set, this fourth module, as you call them, being in place. And it would be incumbent upon the Microsoft to do a new European Essential Guarantees assessment of the UK, wouldn't it?
What would happen if we failed? No, actually, the UK surveillance laws are too expansive. You can send your information to Ireland, but you can't get it back.
Well, that's a possibility, but that's where the supplementary measures come in, and then and this is the work, isn't it? The supplementary measures, and then potentially reworking your entire data model. So you might have a customer number elsewhere, and then just refer in Microsoft. You might have to re-engineer your entire data systems to cater for that. But again, I think that they would probably say, well, yeah, EEG's report about this, and therefore supplementary measures are implemented to mitigate it. But, are Microsoft going to do this? I suspect they will, because they want the business.
Yeah, I suspect they will as well. Are you going to jump in there, Oliver? Because I just saw you.
I was just going to say, I think that's kind of what I was getting at previously, where it's fine for the large organizations to be able to do that, because I think they have the resources, they have the time, and they're able to do that. But as I was saying before, if you're a smaller supplier based in one of these situations where you would have to look into EEGs and supplementary measures for transfers back to the UK, I think that's going to be really quite burdensome for you. I think it's really going to sort of affect the market in that capacity.
I think it's got potential. I could agree with that, because I think it's got potential that it could act as a bar. So with Microsoft, they may feel forced into supporting it, because commercially, if they don't, they could, in a moot point, could financially lose out. So there could be a big implication if they don't do it. So therefore, the hands are tied. They're going to have to do it anyway. But for the smaller organisations that aren't there, you could potentially see it as being a bit of a bar.
Oh, it will be, I think, yeah.
So I think Olu's got a very valid point.
Yeah, I was picking Ollie's brains on Monday, actually. Was it on Monday about this? I said to him, yeah, it was after the weekend, I wanted all the French protests about this new French law. And I was kind of ribbing you a little bit, saying, you know, it's all right for the French as a member state to introduce a new law that's not dissimilar to the Investigation Powers Act. In fact, it might be even more sweeping, but, you know, that doesn't affect their standing in terms of European Essential Guarantees, does it? Although, you know, once you're out of the club, then you've got different rules to play by.
Yeah, well, we'll see what happens, because, I mean, there's been a real backlash to these French security laws that have just come in. So much so, I mean, I don't know how much you will have all have followed it, but the main issue seems to be with this Article 24, which is not necessarily that relevant for our purposes, but it's about basically not being able to publish footage or photographs of police officers on duty. And obviously the subtext to that is that if there are officers committing about abuses of power, they can't be held accountable. So basically there's been a huge backlash around this, and it's gone back to the Supreme Court, and it looks like it's going to change. So we'll see what happens on that. But you're absolutely right that I think by virtue of our situation politically anyway, we're playing a very different ball game to the rest of the club, as you say.
But there is a wider argument as well, isn't it? When you're looking at looking at the implications of FISA being foreign intelligence, and kind of the ability for public authorities to snoop in that sense and find information on people, because the essential guarantees are just making sure that the level of protection in the EU is maintained wherever the information goes. It certainly doesn't prohibit snooping. It just says if you're going to snoop, you can't snoop anymore. Than what the EU's already doing. You've got to be proportional, it's got to have protections there, you've got to have redress for the data subject.
Yeah, it's quite right, Dave, yeah.
But it's certainly not saying you can't snoop, it's just saying you've got to have protections in place if you are going to do it.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point, because there was four of the essential guarantees, wasn't there? And you know, it requires a framework and independence, and yeah. So, yeah, good point. Is there anything else we need to kind of cover off on this scenario? So the Office 365 is a good one, isn't it? Because the data is in Dublin, and I think what people were saying last week is that Microsoft have said that they can't repatriate it into servers in the UK for at least a year. Now, you know, again, you've got data centres to build and all that kind of stuff, so you can see that it might take a period of time. So it could well be that there's a implementation period that we get or not, you know, but This is what something was raised last week, wasn't it, by the participants on the session. Is there anything else we need to talk about on this one, do you think?
No, I think we've kind of covered it. We've got the flow with the points that we need to kind of consider. I think it's kind of covered the main points, at least for the purposes of this session. Yeah.
Yeah. So I still maintain that once the European Essential Guarantees are done for, you know, the US or the state of Florida within the US, then they are the same for every other transfer to that territory, because it's territorially orientated.
I think that's a key point. If you think about the slightly different setup within Germany, the different federal bits within Germany with the different supervisory authorities, like within the US where you've got the CPPA and bits and pieces, it may well have to be state by state in the US, and possibly similarly in Germany, on depending what the local laws suggest. So I'm not quite sure whether you'd have EEGs covering Germany in the same sense you cover the US, or whether it'd have to be state by state, because there may well be different laws in Texas as to California as in so it may have to be state by state within a country, as opposed to like the US or Germany in that case, because of the way the constitution's set up.
Yeah, is that what you call them in Germany, federal bits?
That's a technical term, very rarely used.
Oh, right, okay, yeah. I must be misreferring to them as landers, but there you go. Right, we're going to move on to the so there's Microsoft being a process of sat in the middle. The issue is the breach of the US authorities. So similar, yeah, and not wanting to pick on Castleton particularly, but again, it could be any any organization that is sub, you know, processing, in fact, sub processing in India. So, you know, we are a controller. We've appointed a UK processor. The UK processor is appointing an Indian sub processor, you know, to act as a technical support. So, you know, when those technical support people log on to our systems and start looking at the personal data, you know, within those systems in order to fix a bug in the software, then that transfer is regulated in exactly the same way as the US transfer by these new European Essential Guarantees, and then the transfer mechanism, probably supplementary measures. Again, is that how you see it? You know, India being, you know, again, a completely different use case, but once you've cracked India as a use case in terms of due diligence, probably you've done it for all your suppliers in India.
I'd have to look into it just to be fully certain, but I would have said that was similar to what we discussed earlier when we mentioned India previously, and again, considering whether India's got independent states within the country of India that you might have localized laws you need to consider. In that sense, I think the biggest issue that I have really with some suppliers and information going to India is the fact that because the individuals sat in India are accessing information that's sat in the UK, for example, or in the EU, they don't necessarily consider it as an international transfer.
Well, yeah, that's again an issue, isn't it, that needs to be looked at. I mean, when you look at the CNIL's assessment of India, you know, they are not particularly impressed. You know, there are data protection laws, is what it says, but it doesn't actually go any further. So if you were using this as a tool to do the EEGs, you'd be saying, right, okay, well, you know, it isn't adequate, therefore we need to do some further digging. So then you might flick into, you know, one of these and start having a read and other sources and potentially engaging legal advice in India to find out about the national laws and the national practices. Again, that's how I would see it working in practice.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I think the whole lot highlights it's your due diligence is going to get a lot more onerous, because I've certainly seen due diligence exercises where they ask a supplier, are you processing personal information, or you are processing information and how you're protecting it, and individuals, the part of the questions will be, are you transferring or sharing data, which the answer is no, and then or yes, and then it kind of is left at that point, and there's not that kind of continued down the supply chain. Well, who are you sub-processor? Who else are you working with? Where else is our information going? That kind of, can you demonstrate that it doesn't actually go out of the EU or the UK? Those kind of questions from a due diligence point is very regularly missed. That I see. So the whole implication of trying to factor this into any due diligence process naturally means your due diligence is going to take longer, is going to be more work, ultimately, and needs to be started earlier in the process.
Go on, Ollie.
Sorry, I was just going to say, in line with that, Dave, do you think maybe we might start to see a scenario where increasingly we've decided that we've done our EEGs on a country who implemented supplementary measures, we've decided that the US or India or pick another is appropriate, and we can send data there, and therefore we're happy with that. So we're going to get to a point now, possibly in the future, where all of a sudden we're doing due diligence on the supplier, and they say, oh, well, actually, we send data to a country which we've not yet assessed. And we sort of go, well, actually, we don't really like the look of that. It's quite a lot of work to do this assessment. This other supplier, they send data to a country which we have assessed. We're going to go with them instead. Do you think there's scope for it to start affecting decisions like that?
You mean scope for like the supply chain affecting things?
Yeah, essentially.
So kind of supply chain fed. Because we've seen that with other, maybe not sub-processing, we've certainly seen processes that have come to us for work because their clients are saying, unless you can demonstrate that you are compliant, we're not going to work with you. And so some organisations are coming to us in order to become compliant because they now see financially that they're losing out as a consequence. So you could potentially see elements where the supply chain will affect it, because you know yourself under the Article 28 conditions, if a processor is going to appoint a sub-processor, you've kind of got this approach where they've got to tell you that we're going to appoint another organisation. But at what point within there do they say we're going to appoint this other organisation, and by the way, the information is going to go to India, for example, have you got an appropriate agreement appropriate mechanisms in place to govern that process, as opposed to just saying we're working with this particular organisation, for example?
Well, they can't transfer data internationally without written instruction, can they, under Article 28 anyway? So, it kind of puts a premium on some contracts, doesn't it? You know, this contract, you know, might be at a contract price of £10 per whatever it is, and this contract might be at a price of £9 per whatever it is, but actually there's a premium of £20,000 in legal fees to get that second contract, which appears cheap on the face of it, off the ground because of the international transfer element of it. So, I mean, the sensible thing to do...
I would agree. But just coming back to the point about a written agreement, you see some process agreements where you agree in advance that they can appoint, as long as they tell you and you don't disagree within 30 days. As opposed to doing it on a case-by-case basis. So within that, in notifying you that you're appointing a sub-processor, for example, it's not just we're now going to be working with ABC Limited, for example. They're going to have to come back with, we're going to work with ABC Limited, and they're based in wherever, and they're going to be sending information to whomever in that case in order for you to assess whether you actually agree with that appointment or not.
Yeah. Well, I was working on the basis that if it was a transfer to a new processor in a different country, then Article 28.3a kicks in, which says that processes facilitated only on documented instructions of authority, including regard to transfers. So if it's a new country, I mean, it means that we've got to get more detail in these Article 28 standard contractual clauses, I would have said, that, you know, where are we authorising the data to go? Where have we done EEGs? And you know, it could be state, it could be, you know, territory, it could be land, or it could be federal bits or whatever. But if it's as simple as we're going to appoint a new processor in the same territory, less tricky. If it's I want to appoint a new processor in a different territory, then it's going to have to go through another control process, isn't it?
And hence a more obligation around due diligence, just to make sure.
But I mean, not wanting to throw a hand grenade in, but I mean, we're always brought in at the last minute, not us as a business, but the data protection professionals. You know, we're not consulted on, we're thinking of changing to, you know, mailer or, you know, dot mailer, or it's always an afterthought, isn't it? We need to change culture. We need to.
Absolutely. And I fully agree with you. We need to change culture because the culture predominantly at the moment gives the impression that data protection stops stuff. And I spend half my time saying we're not a blocker or enabler. And the reason why we come across as a blocker is because you're bringing me in very, very late and I've got to do my own processes and go through bits and pieces as we've discussed today, for example. But if you bring me in at a lot earlier process, then we can start raising these issues very early on. And then you'll find that data protection isn't necessarily a blocker. It's an enabler. Obviously, where there's an absolute dead end, we're going to have to say you can't physically do that because and kind of explain that. But let's not be considered a blocker when, in essence, we're just late to the party because we're never told about it in time.
Yeah. But I mean, Ollie.
Sorry, I was just going to say that's a really excellent point, Dave. Just recently, I've been doing some work with one of our housing clients who went out to tender for a new loan worth tracking system. And we actually built data protection into the whole process from the very start. We started the DPI before they even went out to tender, and we even included some data protection focused questions in the tender submissions, or the RFQ rather. And all of a sudden, you get a process which is much more streamlined. We are doing due diligence, which is much easier. DPIA is all much easier. Issues around the processor agreement have been minimal. So as you say, if you brought in from that early stage, I know it's probably not the topic for today, but if you brought in at that early stage, all of a sudden everything's a lot smoother.
Yeah, I was going to say, logically, it makes sense for the suppliers to do the due diligence on the territories that they want to operate in or are operating in. And I was going to suggest that potentially, you know, there's a role for the governing bodies or regulators or, you know, certain trade associations to do it on behalf of their members as well. So you could imagine that, well, you couldn't imagine necessarily the National Federation for Housing taking on board the responsibility for getting around these 280 nations or territories or more if it's subdivisions of and, you know, undertaking that due diligence on behalf of their members, but maybe that's a role that they could play. Same, we were talking about the Premier League, didn't we, earlier on when we've been doing work there, or the Football Association. You know, they know which countries, you know, data being transferred to, and maybe they could take on a role to undertake that work and hold it centrally. Because I still maintain that once the EEGs are done, they're done. Everyone should be able to enjoy the information on the laws and practices of those various segments of countries. I think I told you we'd only have 20 minutes worth of stuff to talk about. You don't have to know how to rabbit on. Listen, the key thing really is really what we should be doing about it, isn't it, and how to document it. Now, I when I was driving to Bangor yesterday, I was kind of mapping in my mind how we're going to revise data-wise to detail all these different relationships and visualize it in visual flows. But, you know, let's just plod through this, because I think this is the essence of it. You know, what should you be doing right now? You shouldn't certainly be leaping about saying, you know, you got to sign these new clauses, because they're not determined yet, are they? As you said earlier, Dave.
No, absolutely. The standard contractual clauses, a public consultation ends tomorrow. So there's still, if you want to make comment and you want to have an input, then you're going to have to jump on it pretty quick.
Yeah. So the hopefully everyone has got lists of, you know, a register of either data disclosures or at the very least processes. So we should know where data is being disclosed, leaving the organization. That's how I would define it. And so that's like step one. Again, dive in, because I'm just going to kind of rattle through this, but dive in and elaborate. So if we've got all those in a list, then we need to pick out which ones are processed, because they're governed by Article 28 contracts, aren't they? But we might be disclosing data to a different organization who's a controller, and we need to know about those types of things as well, don't we? So this is now not just a list of processes, it's a list of disclosures. Would you anything to add to that or challenge it?
No, I'd agree. I think it's maybe not just limited to processes. If you're sharing information with a controller in a different company, you certainly need to know about your data transfer. So I would have said the having accurate and complete data mapping is vitally important to most of this. In that sense, I would agree.
And what about internal companies? So, you know, you've got divisions within an organization, an international organization. I mean, they are disclosures, aren't they? They are going to cross borders. Therefore, they need to be considered in this mix.
Yeah, absolutely. Just because you've got an office in, well, we haven't, but say we had an office in the Seychelles, for example, it's still a
good idea. It's a good idea.
I'll put them across in the new year and just see if I can identifying the appropriate locations. Yeah. So absolutely, I think it's trying to understand that, and also quite a technical point. We certainly discussed this last time. Is identifying, well, are you actually disclosing? Are you is the information in transit only, or is it a transfer? And having that documented as well, because it, like you say, it could be routed through a different country as a non-stop cyclical process. As one of my clients asked a question recently in relation to their emails being bounced through the US. Or was it actually transferred? Does it stop there? Is it kind of recorded there before it's continued and that kind of thing? And having real clarity as to what's happening.
Mm. So this is really documenting the data flow, the whole chain from it's being, you know, transferred from our organization, you know, via this methodology to, because you have to have detail, don't you, to this other organization. You need to know the transfer methodology because it might be affecting the supplementary measures. You know, it might make it easier because it's via a VPN, or less easy because it's via some other mechanism. So really this is documenting the data flow chain for each disclosure. So this is, you know, we are disclosing this information. This is the chain it travels on to get where it's going, you know, and potentially to come back. Any of those transfers or disclosures, you know, that involve international transfers, I'm trying to be precise in my language here. So I'm classing a disclosure as effectively data being disclosed to a recipient, some of whom might be processors, others might not be. But as soon as it crosses the border into a third country, it becomes an international transfer, doesn't it? Now, again, the GDPR is distinct cross-border as within the EU, doesn't it? International transfers as transfers to third countries. So as soon as you know you've got a transfer in any of those chains, you know, disclosure or a transfer in any of those chains that is actually to a third country or through a third country or via a third country, then we've got to consider Article 45, 46, Chapter 5, the international transfers bit of it, don't we?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the next job for me is, right, okay, now we've mapped it all out. You know, we know where the data is flowing, and we know which international transfers we've got. Then we know which territories the data is passing through, and therefore we can undertake, you know, a review of, well, what's the legal mechanism for each overseas transfer. Like, this piece of data goes to France. That's okay, because it's an adequacy decision. And then it goes on to the Seychelles. Right, okay, well, that isn't an adequacy decision. Therefore, we need some other transfer mechanism in place, like standard contractual clauses. So, again, once you've mapped it, I think it's a lot easier. I can visualize it, and drawing on this map, all these different flags of, you know, this is the transfer mechanism for this leg of that disclosure. So once we've documented that, then it's, right, when we go into third countries, we have to then document that European essential guarantees for each territory or subsection of each territory, depending on what we find when we look at it territorial level. It's a federation. Each state has its own laws, Australia, America, and others. Which state are we going into, or what's the law and practice in that state? So that could be a recyclable bit of work, and it could be something we can share because it isn't dependent upon the transfer or the or it's dependent upon the territory it's going into. But the next step, 7B, is supplementary measures if required for each step of each transfer that's going internationally. Again, sorry if I'm losing anybody. I'm losing you, Dave, or you're following my logic.
No, I'm following your logic. All makes perfect sense. I think I'm going to have to jump in a couple of minutes just because I've got training at 1:30. But I think the supplementary measures is key to try and understand what some of those supplementary measures may be. In addition to having your EEGs in place, it may well be things like, is encryption sufficient? Are you going through a synonymization, for example? So if the information's in other countries, is it in an identifiable format, or is it only identified back once it reaches the UK or the EU, for example?
Yeah.
And all those kind of different mechanisms for supplementary measures to improve or enhance security.
Yeah, and we covered those off last time, so we're not going to go into detail on them now. But again, if we want to do another session on picking out those supplementary measures, because there are conditions for effectiveness of those supplementary measures. So again, it's not a ticky box exercise. There's quite a meaty bit of work there.
And I think there is. And just for the very key point, the final bit is, because you mentioned last time, and I think it's quite valid, is the fact that some supplementary measures may not work in some territories, because I think the example you gave was, sending information that's encrypted may not be acceptable in encrypted form in certain countries that it's going to.
Yeah.
So it's having a kind of that an understanding as well of supplementary measures and which ones are actually open to choose from, shall we say, and which ones are absolutely no-go.
Yeah. So I would suggest that anything between 1 and 6 we should have done or have to do now. You know, we have to understand this stuff because it's a moving piece, isn't it, this? And we know the direction of travel because of all these recommendations that have come out from the European Data Protection Board, and we know that there's a big question mark over UK adequacy. So I would say that, you know, what we should be doing now is anything between 1 and 6, we get on with it right now. Hopefully we're on with it, and hopefully it's something we did when the GDPR came into effect 2 years ago. Point 7, I'd say, well, until that's all been ratified, that the recommendations have been, you know, properly formally adopted and the new model clauses have been ratified and adopted and the consultations closed, then I wouldn't suggest trying to move on those points 7A and 7B unless you just try and work out, well, how would we do 7A? You know, have we got legal counsel? Have we got a network of offices that we can ask to do that work for us? So, you know, you wouldn't necessarily go and do it, I don't think, but I might consider how I'd go and do it. You know, what is this, these free resources, are there more that I haven't referred to today?
Yeah, for sure. I think the only thing I would add in there as well would be possibly considering if you do transfer to third countries at the moment, say you are using MailChimp in the US or US-based MailChimp, that kind of thing, and the information is in the US. Whether there's a quick and easy solution to bring it back to the EU and use a different email platform provider. So it's whether you're only doing this process for the really complex bits and really technical and really the kind of the software bits that you're so ingrained with, there's no quick fix solution and quick fix solutions, whether you need to go down the track of, well, do we wait and see? Do we consider alternatives? Not necessarily moving, but do we need to consider what the alternatives are? Should we need to operate quite quickly?
Yeah. That's a good point, because just starting .mailer rather than MailChimp is like an afternoon's job, isn't it? But moving your CRM out of Salesforce or Office 365 onto a new platform is particularly if it's all got to be built and configured is a mean, you know, no mean undertaking.
For sure, and I've been through a CRM change with an organisation, and it's a horrendous piece of work. Well, it's a good piece of work, but it takes time. It's by the time you've gone through all the tested beta testing and all that kind of stuff to make sure that the how it all integrates with the organisation is not implications further down the line for something else.
Yeah.
So it's not a short piece of work when you're talking about, well, we've got to move from this CRM to that CRM. You're talking many months of work.
Yeah. Right. You've got to jump off to get on with your next session of training, haven't you? So thank you very much, Dave, for joining us. Ollie and I will just carry on for a few minutes more and talk about a few bits of current affairs. But I know you've got to. So
yeah,
you dive off when you dive off when you're ready. I mean, Ollie, I think that, you know, my assessment of how we could help people is, you know, probably in a couple of days we could have a look at, you know, these lists of disclosures or help put them together or put a framework together. and processes and you know, to try and do a, you know, some sort of audit, you know, gap analysis. You know, this is what you need to do. This is the current state you're at. You know, we've only documented processes. Right, well, you need to go further. You know, the gap is you've got to document your disclosures, and this is how we recommend you do it. And the other thing I'm doing, we are going to build out DataWise. I mean, it's a relational database. So, you know, you can have EEGs as a record and link it to all the various transfers you document elsewhere in the database. So I've got in my mind now how that looks as a data model. I'm going to talk to the developers to kind of start building that out in a sandbox. But do you think I'm under egging it there, Ollie, in terms of point A? Do you think it's a much more massive piece of work, or do you think it's start up with a gap analysis?
No, I'd probably agree with that, and that's generally what I've been recommending so far. I mean, particularly with, I think, what we've touched on today, which is a certain degree of uncertainty around some of these things, particularly elements which are yet to be ratified. There's a certain almost natural block in the road to us progressing this as far as we'd possibly like it to be at an early stage. So I think, as you say, it's probably just a case of preparing at this stage and really making sure you've got your affairs in order. And as you say, that sort of gap analysis would be a really good step to start that process off.
Yeah. Now, I've not been on the conversation here at all, so I don't know if we've got any questions. I mean, if we've got a ton of questions, it might be that we have to maybe next week do a session just on, right, okay, we've talked about the recommendations from the European Data Protection Board. We've talked a little bit about how it might come to life in terms of what you've got to do. It might be that when people have considered it, we put another session on next week and then start to think about, you know, the specific scenarios a bit more and maybe getting under the skin a bit more. I don't know if I'll get a chance to go through all of these questions. Oh, actually, there's only two questions. Three questions.
Yeah, as far as I can tell, it's primarily down to, I think, a point we made earlier relating to buy-in from an organisational perspective and bringing in data protection at an earlier stage on the supplier onboarding process. And there's just been a bit of conversation on the chat about that.
Yeah. But it is hard to get buy-in. I mean, what we find often is that we often get used as a battering ram. We get the bullets to fire from the information governance team and we rock up to the board and we fire them. And we found, I mean, this is absolutely no reflection on the people we work with, but we find that because we're external and you know, positioned as experts, you know, we get listened to. And if we say this is going to be a real problem, you've got to do something about it. Often it gets more airtime than the internal team saying exactly the same thing. So again, if we can help, you know, with presentations to board and discussions to board and, you know, elaborate on the points, then, you know, again, we're happy to do that where it adds some strength to the arguments that all these, you know, people here are pushing.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, that's what I hear a lot back from the client base is that just purely by virtue of us being external, there's a greater willingness to listen to us at board level or at senior management level, which is frustrating for a lot of our clients. But at the same time, I suppose it's valuable to have us there.
Yeah. Now, I think I don't know if we've got anything further to talk about on this session about this, but I was interested to see that the European Data Protection Board at their plenary session were resurrecting the EU privacy regulation, and they've decided that it's something they really have to push through pretty darn quickly. But there's a few nuances to it, but it looks like that's going to kind of pick up more momentum. It's gone dead, hasn't it, for a couple of years, that one. Did you see that?
Yeah, I was quite surprised to read that, actually. Funnily enough, we did it recently for a prospective client, and they picked up on this, and so I did some digging. Yeah, it's really quite surprising, actually. As you said, the urgency behind it is, confusing, to be completely honest. I'm not entirely sure where this has come from. I mean, to be completely fair, we have seen a lot of activity across the European regulators on enforcement of sort of cookies and wider marketing practices, so that would fit into that. So perhaps that's sort of where that's come from to a degree. Mm. But no, it is actually quite surprising.
Well, the last version of it I read, you know, the draft version of the privacy regulation, there wasn't actually much change to cookies, and there wasn't much change to unsolicited direct marketing, you know, emails and phone. Most of the emphasis of the change was capturing over-the-top technologies like Skype that sit on the internet but aren't actually regulated by the PECA. And Internet of Things devices, again, there's no real regulation around, and yet they have proven time and time again to be a vulnerability. That famous fish tank that was the route into the casino. Remember that story? And the regulation of telecoms, you know, and privacy around telecoms and interception messages, they seem to be forward. I guess Internet of Things and over-the-top services will affect us, but in terms of our direct activities like e-marketing, I haven't seen much change. So unless the change, the text of the draft privacy regulation, but again, the big question is, well, will it apply to us? We won't be bound by e-regulation. So what will we do?
No, it's a very good point. And I suppose it's looking into how, I think it's something we touched on actually possibly last week, is to what degree we will still give weight to the European regulators, European case law and legislation, and whether we continue to sort of bear that in mind to a degree. I think if we sort of, to bring it back around to the topic of the day, I think if we are looking to secure adequacy or at least stay on side with our European counterparts, I think it's going to be important that we continue to take these things into consideration, at least at some level.
I'll tell you what would be funny, Ollie. What would be funny is if the UK takes e-privacy regulation and implements it as domestic law before the EU gets e-privacy regulation in place. That would be really funny, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I'd enjoy that. But, yeah.
Right, okay. So it's 13:36. I think we've probably run out of time. I'm not sure we've exhausted the topic. I think we could talk again for the rest of the afternoon and most of tomorrow about this.
I was going to say, I'm not sure it's entirely possible.
I'm not sure we've picked up on much in the news, but there's been quite a lot going on. I was interested that the Canil fine for Carrefour was partially for cookies, wasn't it? You placing cookies out of consent.
Yeah, it was, yeah. There's a whole series of things, as we discussed at the start of the session.